Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have a special guest here in Studio 2 today. Governor Charlie Baker is with us. Lots to talk about. MBTA, transit, budgets, national conversation around abortion, taxes, driver's license, so much. So let's just dive right in. Governor Baker, it's been a minute. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for all that free time.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So listen, I got to tell you, in thinking about today, there's tons of policy stuff to talk about, but I'm also thinking a lot about the fact that you're in the home stretch now on your governorship. And what's been playing in the back of my head is I have a grandfather who, when he finished his career as an engineer, he wanted to go on to other stuff, started having a recurring dream in the last 6 months or so that he would take his alarm clock out and put it on a stump, get his shotgun, and shoot his alarm clock. And he had it every day until the day it was done. And I'm kind of wondering, what's the vision in your head? You know, are you going to take your phone out and shoot it? You know, what's the vision in your head for the big change that you're looking forward to in this piece?
To tell you the truth, I really haven't figured out what I'm looking forward to. I can tell you this, the alarm clock that I have, believe it or not, is the same one I've had for literally 20 or 30 years. I mean, I don't know how far, but this thing goes back to, I think, before my wife and I had kids. But the one thing, there's not much in my mind at this point. I'm pretty focused on the rest of the legislative session and a bunch of things we've been trying to get done between now and the end of the calendar year. But the one thing my wife and I have agreed on is when this is all over, she and I are going to spend some time together doing something, we don't know what, for some period of time that's more than a few days. But other than that,
like
I don't
go
have
away,
any plans.
Some quality time.
Right. Something like that.
Yeah. Are you a big fan of international travel? Are you a woodsy person?
You know, this is funny. A lot of people during the pandemic kind of discovered the parks all over the place, which was awesome and amazing, and we had to do all kinds of things with our own state parks just to sort of upgrade our presence and our activity to meet the demand. But, you know, my wife and I have lived on the North Shore with our family since the early 90s, and for years my wife has been saying to me, we should go for a walk in the Lynn Woods. And I've always just kind of, I just always found a reason not to. And when there was really nothing else to do other than work, we started going for walks in the Lynn Woods, and I have a whole phone full of photos about our walks in the Lynn Woods. I think the Lynn Woods is one of the coolest places I've ever been. It's a real jewel. I think it's the second largest municipal park in the United States beside the Central Park in New York, and I love that stuff. But I think one of the things we may do is try and go visit some friends who, I mean, I really haven't left Massachusetts hardly at all since the beginning of the pandemic. And I think one of the things we'll do is try and go visit some friends that we haven't seen in a long time, and maybe some family too.
Yeah. And I wasn't planning on this. This wasn't
the shotgun of the alarm clock is an interesting concept, though. I'll have to think a little about that one.
He actually did it, for the record. He did actually shoot his alarm clock, and it blew up big. All right. So one other thing on the fun front before we dive in, because it just occurred to me, I owe you a thank you for Ted Lasso in my life during the pandemic. I remember we were covering State of the Commonwealth. You made that Ted Lasso reference that night. Everybody's, you know, texting, who the heck is Ted Lasso? Huge fan of Ted Lasso that we only started watching because of you and the State of the Commonwealth. Why'd you love him so much?
Because Ted Lasso is about kindness and humor and teamwork and collaboration. And it was an enormously positive and optimistic program at a point in time when almost everything that was on TV was dark. And everything that was going on in the world at large was super high anxiety. And Ted Lasso, to some extent, was just this giant oasis of good people and positivity and optimism. And the other thing, of course, is I think it's incredibly well scripted, incredibly well acted, and I'm, you know, I've tried very hard and will try very hard to live up to that whole be curious, not judgmental, Walt Whitman line that plays out in that beautiful scene in the bar with the the dart game.
Yeah.
Season three is coming this summer,
coming soon.
I expect you to tune in.
Absolutely. Was COVID, being in charge and having that unfold, the darkest time in your life?
It was certainly the darkest time of my career. Honestly, I think the darkest time of my life was probably watching my mom go through Alzheimer's and dementia, which you and I have talked about. But in terms of, you know, the most challenging thing I've ever had to do as a as an executive, as a professional, there's never been anything like COVID. I mean, you have this constantly shifting sand around what we know and what we don't know with this virus that is also constantly changing and literally just completely unpredictable. I said at one point that it's a little bit like fighting Michael Myers from the Halloween movies. It just constantly, you know, dies and then just constantly comes back to life.
Back.
And I do believe that Massachusetts, and I was on calls with all kinds of governors all the way through this, I do believe that Massachusetts sometimes under, just because we're all here and that's kind of what we know, I think we sometimes don't appreciate that people here in the Commonwealth on a wide range of issues and circumstances around COVID really did wonderful things for each other. When we were looking for folks to help us with food insecurity, we asked for volunteers and organizations to help. We got a million hands up. Same thing with testing, same thing with vaccines, same thing with pretty much anything and everything where we needed to find people to help us help others. And I don't, there are a lot of parts of the country where, you know, people struggled to find people to help with a lot of that stuff. And that just wasn't the story here. And I've said in many audiences I've talked to over the past 5 or 6 months that people need to understand that, you know, the people in Massachusetts really rose to the occasion in a big way.
Best thing you did, biggest mistake you made?
I think the best thing we probably did was trying to stay in front of the public as often as we could. I mean, I didn't really count, but it felt like to me like we did somewhere between 90 and 100 days in a row of press conferences where we kind of took all the questions and just tried very hard in the early months of the pandemic to just make sure people knew that this is what we knew and this is what we were doing and this is what we were looking for people to do and all the rest. I think many of the issues around almost everything associated with long-term care, which became just a terrible tragedy in a number of instances and a really big challenge overall, is probably the single biggest thing that we were slow to respond to. And once we did many things that were nation-leading with respect to how to protect seniors and folks in long-term care facilities. But that would probably be the thing that I would have liked to have gotten to faster.
We got some news this morning from New England Public Media about a settlement that's coming out in federal court, $56 million, about between the families of the people who died at the Holyoke Soldiers Home during the COVID outbreak. Comments on that? Thoughts?
Well, first of all, that was a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy, and I called 100 families that lost somebody during the spring. I couldn't have a meeting because COVID, but I called 100 families. I talked to 80 of them, plus or minus, and some of those phone calls lasted 5 minutes, and some of them lasted an hour. And that was my opportunity to both express my grief and to give people a chance to talk to me about their family member and about the home and the circumstances and situation. I think the fact that people engaged in what I would describe as a good faith discussion about how to deal with this this issue was a positive one, and I'm glad we have a resolution, and I hope it provides people with some closure.
Next 7-8 months, you said at the beginning, you're really focused on the sort of the legislative agenda. What's the top priority?
I don't really think I have a top priority here. I have a lot of priorities. I mean, we have an economic development bill that has significant resources for all 351 cities and towns in Massachusetts on projects that have already been vetted and approved and are ready to go. I'm very worried that if we don't get something done on that this spring or this summer and enacted so that people have certainty, well, the supply chain issues and the labor issues and all the other things that are a problem means that this thing will, you know, it will push all these projects out for years before they get done at a point in time where we really need to be moving forward. I really hope that at some point we'll see some other pieces of legislation land on our desk. I would love to see the what we're calling the Mass Track bill, which is a big infrastructure bill that leverages the federal money that was involved in the bipartisan infrastructure law in Washington. I mean, there's billions and billions of dollars there. And it's not just transportation. It's also broadband. It's also environmental infrastructure. It's clean water. There's a whole bunch of really important pieces to that. And a lot of the opportunities associated with it are formula driven, but a lot of them are also competitive. And the feds are already starting to put some of the wheels in motion around the competitive stuff. And I want us to have a bill that's in place that demonstrates that we have the resources we need to have, and we've done all the work we needed to do on our end to bid competitively and to win on a lot of those projects. And there are some pretty well-known projects that are tied up in this, sort of like the most well-known might be the Cape Cod bridges, which is, I think, for everybody here, something that's long overdue. I would really like to see the legislature do something on tax cuts. And we have an incredible surplus on the tax revenue side. And everybody's dealing with the rising cost of everything, food, rent, gas, just daily life. And we made a series of proposals on tax relief in January that were designed to help low-income. We have a lot of people who pay taxes in Massachusetts who are low-income wage earners who make so little income, they don't pay taxes at the federal level. That just shouldn't be true in Massachusetts. You know, we shouldn't have a lower standard for low-income people paying taxes than the federal government.
So you're saying that we're asking people to pay taxes who don't at the federal level, and you don't think they should be here at the state level because of their
income? No, I think at a minimum we should have the same standard the feds have, which, you know, is hundreds of thousands of people who could probably use that money. I feel the same way about the rental deduction. We haven't changed the rental deduction in Massachusetts, I think, since I worked in state government in the 90s. Rents have obviously gone up since then, and they've gone up a lot in the past 2 years. I think the dependent care tax credit, if ever there was a time when people were coming out of a pandemic to do something to put a lot more money into something like the dependent care tax credit, which, you know, again, would benefit hundreds of thousands of families. I mean, these to me are things we should... We should get done.
So progressive state, Democrats in the House and the Senate,
yep.
Their bills have come out. No tax relief in there yet, although they're signaling that they're interested.
Yep.
Why should this be hard to get? I mean, you're going to be able to get it done. The agenda you just laid out sounds to me like what we've heard our Democratic congressional delegation in D.C. talk about for the last 2 years. So it's May.
Yeah, I don't think this is partisan. I mean, many of the tax initiatives that I filed were ones that had been filed by Democrats in the House and the Senate. And we certainly have the resources. You could fund the entire tax package that I filed with just the surplus in April tax revenues. In fact, you could fund it more than once. I mean, revenues were $2 billion over expectations.
And you're talking about $700 million or so.
Right.
So the estate tax, this is the other sticky wicket, right?
Yep.
That you don't like the million-dollar level. I think the argument is a lot of people who have lived in their houses for a long time now have a million-dollar house and would have to pay it if they pass it down to their kids.
There are only 16 states that even have an estate tax. And
but
no state has an
dying
estate
on?
Tax that's like ours. I mean— Oregon also has a million dollar threshold, but they don't start taxing you until you get over the $1 million. And they only tax you on the overage over $1 million.
Julian
Sear, senator down on the Cape, liberal Democrat, big believer in doing something about the estate tax because he's watching people leave Massachusetts specifically because they look at that and they say, I have a house that's worth $1 million. I leave it to my kids, they're going to have to pay taxes on it. Maybe they're in a position to do that. Maybe they aren't. And I think even, you know, even people who are generally speaking, not that interested in tax relief, look at that one and just say it's a competitive issue.
So one more time, understanding this, is the bundle of this critical to you? Kind of a deal breaker.
Sure. Well, I wouldn't look. If I, you know, I've spent over 15 years of my professional career working full time in state government, either as an appointed cabinet member or as governor, and I'm well aware of the fluidity of the public process, and I get it. It's a team sport, right? And what I guess I would say is, I think whether it's there were seven elements in our tax bill. They helped a lot of people who I don't think anybody would argue wouldn't need our help if we had the resources to help them, and or represented a significant sort of place where we are just competitively in a completely different place than the rest of the country. So I would expect and anticipate that those items would be attractive to a legislature looking to do something for people who are dealing with 8% and 9% inflation and the cost of most of the things they buy.
Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. So I've got some of the things I want to dive into. We have been asking elected officials some lightning round questions when they come in, and we found that everybody wants to know the answer to iced coffee or hot coffee. So which one are you, and do you switch during the year, or are you a purist one way or the other?
I'm usually a hot coffee in the morning, and if I drink coffee in the afternoon, it's iced coffee.
So you're a both and all the time.
If I do, I usually don't do it in the afternoon, but if I do, it's usually iced coffee, yeah.
All right.
Because then I feel like the hot coffee thing I just associate with getting out of bed.
So it's a functional thing for you. Yeah. All right. So listen, I'm imagining, this isn't real, but a table in the office that's got the portfolio of things that you're responsible for on it. Like, you know, almost like a diorama.
Yep.
Where does the T sit in that?
Well,
and given the FTA stuff this week, how much is your, use a phrase I've heard you use before, how much is your hair on fire about it?
I actually welcome the FTA for a lot of reasons. First of all, the MBTA is, as we all know, one of the oldest public transportation systems in the country. What most people don't know is how wildly underinvested it was for a very long time. I mean, we've spent close to $5 billion since we took office, which maybe even six, which you just won't find any administration that's ever spent as much on investing in the core system as we have.
But was it enough?
Well, we started with a backlog, a state of good repair number that was more like 12 or 14. So there's a limit to just how fast you can get dollars out the door to begin with. But more importantly, it's an old system. And it because it's an old system, it has challenges. And I think people have done a fairly significant amount of important work to fix many of those issues and to modernize the system. But what the FDA will bring, among other things, is a lot of information and a lot of knowledge about what the rest of the country does and how other systems manage some of their older lines and their older units. And I think in the grand scheme of things, a focus on sort of core operations and that sort of thing, especially with an organization that's actually seen a lot more than sort of certainly anybody has at the T, is a good thing.
We're in a bad stretch, safety-wise. The death of Robinson.
Yeah.
So
another reason why having the FTA here is a good thing, not a bad thing.
I think listeners want to hear from you that you, how you are connecting with this bad stretch that we are in and what it's making you think about and want to do in the remainder of your time, and if there's anything you think you should have done differently.
Well, I would argue that we've been playing catch up since we took office on the T. The system basically shut down 25 days after I took office, and we had to dig it out from under
the snow
and get it back in operation again. And that was one of the reasons we made the decision to spend the money that we spent on modernizing it and investing in the core system, something people just didn't do. I mean, think about the fact that many of the trains that run on the Red Line and the Orange Line are 1960, plus or minus. And there is a program in place to replace those that started under the Patrick administration. It got thrown a little bit into a series of delays because of the pandemic and all that came with that. But we pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the T. We talk regularly to the general manager. We talk regularly to the Secretary of Transportation. But the biggest thing we did was make resources available to them to invest in their capital infrastructure and said to them, spend them on the core system. Spend them on the things that are broken. Spend them on the things that are 40, 50, 60, 70 years old that have never been replaced.
So are we in a moment? Are we in a special, different moment with the T right now? I'm not responsible for the T,
yeah.
Right? But I'm a rider and I hear what our listeners care about. Are we in a moment? And how do you mark that moment?
I think we're in a moment where a focus on continuing to invest in the core system. Remember, we've invested a lot, and a lot of people know we've invested a lot. But there's more that needs to be done there to modernize the system. And the moment is the opportunity the FTA will give the T to actually bring national knowledge into its safety protocols and its policies and its procedures. And I think, you know, I think that's a good thing.
Will you work directly with the FTA? Does it involve your office and you?
The FTA is going to work primarily with the DPU, which because of federal law actually is the safety oversight entity for the public utilities for the T, and with the DOT and the MBTA folks, and with the Management Control Board. I'll participate in the way I'll probably end up participating primarily is through continued conversations with the folks at DOT and at the MBTA. But the direct line is going to be between the FTA and the operating agency, and that's as it should be.
What's the right spend on the T? If you had the money, what is the right spend?
Well, I would argue that, we had never spent, the T had never spent more than $500 or $600 million on its capital program on an annual basis. We've been spending, on average, over $1 billion a year on its capital program over the past several years because of the catch-up that's involved there. I think it's critically important for the capital side for the T to continue to spend at a rate that's similar to that going forward. And more importantly, it's critical that it continue to spend on investing in the core system. You know, I said when I took office and we had that horrible winter that I was going to make sure that the T had resources to spend on investing in its core system. That's not where most people in public life want to spend money. They want to spend it on expansions and this and that, because that's where the public, you know, visibility is. A lot of the money that the T has spent over the past 7 or 8 years, you can't even see. But the bottom line is replacing all the tracks, replacing systems, replacing electronics, signals, switches, power systems. That's where the big opportunity to improve the quality of the service and the performance comes from. And it's not a place where you get much political benefit at all. In fact, I've said to a bunch of people that I never expected to get much political benefit from where the T spent most of the money over the last 7 years. And guess what? I didn't. The only real big political benefit we got was saving the Green Line extension, which was basically dead when we took office. But part of the reason there was political benefit in that was because it was an expansion.
All right, I want to shift tracks, pun intended,
tracks,
I guess.
There you go.
And I want to talk about Roe v. Wade. And I want to ask you if you saw it coming. Or was that a thunderclap for you when it was leaked?
Well,
I mean, the leak you wouldn't have seen coming.
I think it was a thunderclap for everybody. If you followed the original congressional hearings on all these folks, you would not have concluded from the congressional hearings that there was that the votes were there to overthrow it.
So where does that situate Massachusetts? I mean, part of the tension here is between, you know, states' rights, federal government, who's going to make it legal, who's not going to make it legal, where can you get it done, should you help people come to your state to get it done? You know the landscape. What is Massachusetts' responsibility in this moment, assuming that some version of that finding goes forward and they strike down Roe.
Well, I certainly believe that everybody in Massachusetts should know that in Massachusetts we have court decisions and laws that sort of enshrine a woman's right to choose, period. That's not an issue for people here. I do believe, and I said this when I first saw the original opinion, that I believe if that's really where they land when they ultimately issue their decision, it's a major setback for women. And I've also talked to colleagues of mine in the legislature about what, if anything, we need to do to be able to support people who are seeking those kinds of services and can't get them where they live. And that's one of the reasons why I think the House and the Senate have both put additional resources in the budget for...
$2 million on the Senate side.
Right. Service, $2 million or $1.5 million, one or the other.
I think it was two. Okay. I think it's $500K on the House, $2 million on the Senate.
And I think that's a good place to start, but, you know, we need to see a decision before we decide what else we might be able to help with, but I think this is something that should be a high priority for us.
When we enshrine things into law here with the Roe Act, you had disagreements with the legislature about specific pieces of it.
Yep.
You've given a lot of interviews on that, so that's not where I'm going with my question. My question is, you talk about sensibility, you talk about collaboration, you just talked about it with Ted Lasso. Are we in a moment where the details of a number of months, a number of weeks, age limits, et cetera, are going to keep us from making protections that you say are important? And how do you think about how divisive Roe is, especially between Republicans and Democrats in this moment? I mean, you want to talk about a challenge around getting people to an outcome that it seems like the majority of people want.
I do think for the short term, again, until we see the decision, it's hard to draw broad conclusions. But I do think there are going to be people who are seeking these services, who live in states where it would be hard to access them. And that's something that other states where those services are available are going to have to step up.
So let's talk about your party for a minute, because your party.
My July 4th party?
No, your Republican party. Okay. Like you didn't know. I was asking you. Is it time for a new party? Is it time for a third way? And what's your role in either getting the state Republican Party there or getting a third way forward? How do you think about that as one of the most popular governors as a Republican in the country?
Well, I certainly believe that... more than one voice matters. I mean, I would argue that a big part of my growth as a person came from, first of all, listening to my mom and dad, the Democrat and the Republican, debate the issues of the day the whole time I was growing up, and all the people I've had a chance to learn from who I don't agree with all the time. I mean, one of the things that happens if all you do is talk to people who agree with you on everything is you don't learn. You don't get any smarter than you were the day before. And I think so first of all, I think it's really important there be more than one team on the field. I've said this my entire political career, and I had a front row seat to watch it happen when I worked for Governors Weld and Cellucci, and I believe there's been a lot of benefit in having more than one voice on the discussion and that we've had over the past 7 years I've been governor. Constructive friction is a good thing. That said, I do worry that both parties have challenges on this issue. If you look at the Gallup polls...
But I'm going to stop you there just because of time.
Okay.
What's the part you do now, and especially going forward?
Well, I'm certainly going to support candidates that I believe in between now and the time I leave office. And then after I leave office, we'll see what happens after my wife and I spend some time away with one another. But I certainly believe that moderates, and especially moderates who can see, who recognize that politics is a team sport, which it is and should be, need to have a role to play and a voice in making policy, not just here in Massachusetts, but around the country.
Okay, last question for you. Everybody always wants to ask you if you're going to run for president. I want to ask you a different question. Would you ever want to serve in a U.S. cabinet? And if so, what position would be juiciest to you?
You are so far ahead of my supply chain, to use a term we've already used on the show. I am not thinking about stuff like that at all. I'm thinking about the legislative agenda, the work that's in front of us, and the stuff we need to do to continue to move the Commonwealth forward and out of the sort of aftershocks of the pandemic. I'll tell you another thing on the aftershocks of the pandemic. We filed a bill several years ago to dramatically increase state investments in behavioral health, addiction care, primary care, right? We need that bill more than ever coming out of the pandemic, given everything that's happened with regard to substance use disorder, which has exploded, and behavioral
numbers.
Health issues. And, you know, I would really love to see that bill get passed before the end of that session, the end of the session, because if it doesn't, that's $1.4 billion to be invested over the next 5 years in those service areas. And we're going to need that and then some to meet the provider demand and the service demand that we have just for people who are coming out of the pandemic. And honestly, that's where my focus is going to be.
Will you come back to the show?
I don't know. I guess it depends upon whether or not I get invited.
All right. I'm inviting you. And thank you for being here for today. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker here on Radio Boston. Thanks for coming into studio,
Thanks.
Too.